just today that members of subcommittee, this is the first day of a week or 3 days of large agency overviews. Today you have corrections and youth authority, and tomorrow's the judicial branch, and Thursday is state police, military, and I'm missing one, I guess what it is. Another one that's off the top of my head. And DAs are also tomorrow, the same day as the judicial branch. And then next week, just for looking ahead, we will actually start hearing the actual public sort of budget hearings for a number of agencies, Board of Parole, Council, or Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability, and Council on Court Procedures. Then on toward the end of the week, the Department of Justice, which will be a multi-day presentation, will start.
And before I call Max Williams up, some of you may have seen the headlines in the newspaper this morning about the issue of the fraud that went on. So Max is going to address that shortly, but I don't want to get too bogged down in the discussion of that. We'll ask him to come back and report once the investigation is at a point where that report is timely. So with that, Mr. Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do appreciate the opportunity to present a brief overview of the Department of Corrections to the committee. Before I make that presentation, however, I appreciate the chair's indulgence to make a brief statement regarding the recent news accounts involving a federal criminal investigation concerning a DOC employee who is alleged to have taken kickbacks for directing purchases of food items from particular vendors. I'm sure the committee can understand that during this ongoing criminal investigation, there is little additional information that I can share. That said, I do wish to make 3 points to the committee. First, the Department of Corrections is fully cooperating with the federal agencies in this investigation. Our Inspector General's Office and our Special Investigations Unit are assisting these agencies in every possible way. Second, during my 3 years as the director of the department, I have tried to underscore the department's high ethical standards and our code of conduct by personally reinforcing this point with every single management service employee that has been promoted and routinely through various methods throughout the department. I recognize the vast public trust that has been vested in this department, and with that in mind, 2 years ago we established a hotline number to our Inspector General's office for both staff and inmates to report any issues that were in violation of our code of conduct, our standard of ethics, or that were possibly criminal in nature. Any allegations that are potentially criminal in nature are immediately turned over to the state police for an independent investigation. I simply want the committee to understand that we take these issues very seriously. Third, I have committed to the federal agencies conducting this investigation that we will not launch any separate investigation that could impact or hinder their efforts until they have completed their work. Based on the outcome of their investigation, however, I do intend to assure that a review is conducted with the assistance of independent agencies and our own internal auditors to determine whether the Department of Corrections was financially harmed. We will share the outcome of that review with you, and you have my commitment that if the facts determine that the state was in fact harmed, we will vigorously seek recovery of those funds. Again, I appreciate the committee's understanding that while the criminal investigation is ongoing, there is little else I can add at this time beyond what you have read in the newspaper. And now, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll move forward with my presentation of the overview of the Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Please do.
I hope you have in front of you a packet, and that packet says overview of the Department of Corrections on it. And if so, I'd like to take you just briefly, if I can, through that presentation. We're going to just start with some basic fundamentals, and I don't intend to spend a lot of time on each of these slides. I recognize that I've got a time limit in which to do this, so we'll move rather quickly. But I would be happy to pause if you have questions, and if the questions require some additional conversation, we'll note those and try to get back to you as quickly as possible. So just from a foundation standpoint, you'll note that the foundational principles of criminal law are established by the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 15, which we've provided for you there. If you move to the next slide, it just is a review of what we do as a Department of Corrections. We maintain the integrity of the rule of law by ensuring that people serve their sentences as ordered by the court. We protect public safety by running safe and secure prisons, thus separating offenders from society for the duration of their incarceration, and we hold offenders accountable for their actions. Also, as important as the rest of those, we do everything we can to reduce the possibility of future criminal conduct. DOC scope. Oh, all right. I'll move this closer. I can do both of those things. Actually, I can talk louder and move it closer. DOC scope. We currently incarcerate approximately 13,300 adult inmates who are sentenced to felony convictions of 1 year or more, and we directly supervise 2,800 offenders in two counties, Linn and Douglas County, that were counties that opted out during the 2004 opt-out of the Community Corrections Act. I'll mention and talk a little bit more about community corrections generally towards the end of the presentation. Our mission statement is to promote public safety by holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of future criminal behavior. And we do this really using our business strategy, which is the Oregon Accountability Model. The department selects intervention strategies that change antisocial thinking and behaviors and that give offenders skills necessary to become productive law-abiding citizens when they're released from incarceration. I've given you just a brief outline of the OAM, or the Oregon Accountability Model. It has six primary areas of focus: criminal risk factor assessment and case planning, our focus on pro-social staff inmate interactions. We target work and programs to meet those offenders' individual needs. We focus on appropriate children and family relationships, transition and reentry to the community, and then community supervision and programs upon release. And just again on that next slide, below that is just the criminal risk factors that the department uses in preparing what is identified on the following slide as the Oregon Corrections Plan. This corrections plan, after an individual has gone through the intake process at our facility at Coffee Creek, the corrections plan takes the information that's been gained both on health, mental health, the criminal risk factor assessment, and those issues, and builds a corrections plan that is designed to create appropriate interventions in that person's criminal activity. And that corrections plan ideally then drives both the inmate's expectations and where they move and when they move through the system. As you can appreciate, not every facility in the department has the same sets of services, and so it may mean that an inmate is at two or three different facilities over the course of their incarceration where they're receiving services. The next slide on page 5 is DOC's funding source. As you'll note, we are almost entirely general fund funded as an agency. About 6% of our funding comes from other funds. Those other funds include the COP monies that come for construction and expansion projects, as well as for any participation in jail expansion projects, as well as inmate welfare funds and monies derived through inmate work crew contracts. And less than 1% of our funding is from federal funds or grants. So we really are a large general fund funded agency. The next slide on page 6 is one that I'm sure you're all very familiar with, and this is just a breakdown to give you a quick snapshot of the size of the agency from a budget perspective. We're in the public safety realm as compared to the other parts of the state budget. Public safety is 12.2%. When you then divide that 12.2% among its participants, you'll see that DOC, not including the community corrections funding, is 65% of that budget. And if you'll kind of follow that particular pie chart around the corner, you'll see that 14% in addition is the money that is passed through DOC under the Community Corrections Act that goes to local counties to fund community corrections. And the numbers I'm using here are the numbers as reflected in the governor's recommended budget.
Mr. Chair, just the figures that LFO uses includes the judiciary branch into the definition of public safety. Max, Mr. Williams, is just the public safety agencies and not judicial branch. So that's the difference between the 12% and the 16% that we tend to use.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. And if you'd like us to represent it differently, we'd be happy to. This was really just the executive branch public safety agencies that we were reflecting. On The next slide, you'll see the DOC general fund budget by division. And again, noting that we're almost entirely operating off a general fund, you have pretty much a good picture of how the resources are being spent within the department. This does, in fact, include the $235 million that have been identified as the pass-through funding for community corrections, as well as our operations. And you'll note that behind those two items, the next largest item in our budget is debt service at $134 million. So that just gives you about 10% of the overall general fund budget for the department is debt service associated not only with the expansion and construction of facilities by the department over the last 15 years, but also the expansion of jail and county facilities under the Community Corrections Act in 1995, where the state agreed to fund the expansion of jails once the Community Corrections Act was passed. And we'll talk a little bit more about that later. In almost microscopic fashion, I provided you in the next slide a picture of the DOC organizational chart. I will also tell you that a full-size copy of that chart is provided in your packet, so you don't need to lose your eyesight on that, but that gives you a general breakdown of the department, the activities of the director's office, and then the five major divisions in DOC. And as we go into our more full budget presentation later in February, we'll have a chance to talk about each of those divisions and their functions individually. I've also included in your packet a copy of the 2005-2007 Department of Corrections Strategic Plan, and that is in your packet, but I did want to just mention a couple of things relative to the strategic plan. That plan includes our key performance measures that we report to the legislature on, as well as broader performance measures that in 2005 the department established for itself and has continued to follow and monitor, which we'll be prepared to report to you on as we make our full budget presentation. But I want to just make a couple of points. One of the primary things that we're measured on consistently and are the only state agency that reports on this specific statewide benchmark at this time is recidivism and reducing recidivism. And that number currently has hit the benchmark number, which is the first time since 1990 that that's occurred in the state's history, at 28.8%. So we're pleased to report that. We'd like to take all the credit, but we can't. We believe that the reduction in recidivism is driven by a number of issues, but a lot of good work that's also been done by our partners in the community corrections area and the introduction of best practices and evidence-based models and the like that we believe have been driving a reduction in recidivism, as well as other environmental factors and the like. But it's good news that we've hit that target, and we look forward to an opportunity, I think, to discuss resetting that measure as we continue to do everything we can to drive that number down. You'll also see that the two primary areas that we measure as part of our key performance measures focus on transition, issues associated with transitioning offenders back to the community. And I've made this point pretty clearly a number of times with probably each one of you at some time individually, but it's a number that I still think shocks many people, that 97% of everyone who's currently serving time in prison is going to release and return to a community. And so that really drives to us a great focus on our need to work on the transition and reentry aspect of our job. If that particular handoff as a person leaves prison and reenters the community is not given an appropriate level of focus tied to both resources, access to treatment, issues about employment and housing, the odds that a person is going to be successful on that first 180 days when they're in the community are going to be pretty small. So it's really something that we're refocusing and retooling almost constantly, our ability to measure where we're having the impact on transition and reentry. What could we be measuring to give us a better sense of how successful that's actually working or not working? And then where the system unhooks, where the bureaucracies of the Department of Corrections run into a bureaucracy of a county or some other state agency, and efforts around trying to smooth those out. I would tell you personally, I think for an inmate who's spent any considerable amount of time in prison to walk out the door and successfully navigate their requirements and all the things that you have to do when you reenter the community, it's a very challenging experience. And I think we miss and lose people in the system who then recidivate and return to the department having committed a new crime, created a new victim, and ultimately created a substantial additional burden on the taxpayer. The other issues that we measure are the operational measures, and those are things like inmate assaults and staff, walkaways from our facilities, inmates who have particularly high levels of misconduct, and I've noted also there are just the efficiency issues around workers' compensation, time loss claims. Those are really safety and security issues, and those are designed to keep us understanding whether or not we are making progress or not making progress on continuing to operate safe and secure institutions and to protect the people who work for us and the staff and the inmates inside the institution. The next slide gives you a very one-line description of what's provided considerably more in detail in the strategic plan, and these are the 13 strategic initiatives that the department adopted in 2005. Almost all of them are tied, again, back to those primary missions that I've just discussed, and they're laid out for you in more detail in the strategic plan. I simply wanted to just identify them here. These were particular issues that we thought were significant enough to identify as being strategic in nature to the department, improving and accomplishing its mission. Each one of these ended up with someone who was a project manager around this strategic initiative. We sort of used the phrase other duties as assigned and found people within the department who were willing to step forward and take responsibilities along with their regular jobs to assume a project responsibility for each of these strategic initiatives. And they're leading us, obviously, to get a handle on dealing with a number of really key issues for the department. The department has grown at such a rapid rate over time that it has been difficult to kind of go from a system that not many years ago existed with just a handful of prisons to now one that's operating 13 and soon to be 14 facilities and moving and dealing with the issues of a substantially larger inmate population. And these strategic initiatives are really designed around that population management, growth management, and long-term planning focus. The next little comment that I'd like to take you on is just a brief discussion of prison population forecasting and how that relates to the department's planning. As you probably are aware, the prison population forecast is prepared independently of DOC and the community corrections folks. It's prepared by the Office of Economic Analysis in the Department of Administrative Services, and it's prepared twice a year, once in April and October. They use a flow model that's a fairly sophisticated, in fact, I'd say very sophisticated because I don't think I could explain it to you in all its detail, but a very sophisticated flow model of anticipating what the population will be in the future. And from that, then we have that forecast to try to plan for the prison population. They do take input from the Forecast Advisory Committee, and I've given you just a brief rundown of who sits on that committee to show you the diversity of the members the Forecast Advisory Committee, and that group really comes together in advance of the work being done by DAS on the forecast to talk about long-term trends, any changes in practices that might be having an impact on the forecast at the local level, and really to try to anticipate if there are things coming down the pike that might have a significant impact on changing the forecast. And then the forecaster at DAS goes through the process of interpreting all that information and all of the data they use to develop a forecast. And on the next slide, you'll see the October 2006 forecast, which is the most recent forecast, giving you some sense between 2007 forward what's being anticipated currently. And at the end of 2016, it's projected right now in the October 2006 forecast that we'll be slightly above 16,000 offenders. This may look rather stark. I would simply tell you that it's a substantial improvement over the forecast in April 2005. And we can get into more of that in the next more detailed presentation. But there has been some moderation in the forecast between 2005 and the October 2006 forecast. That moderation in the forecast has had a significant impact on planning for the department. In April of 2005, we fully anticipated having to come back to the legislature this session and ask you for the full cost associated with the construction of our next prison, which would either be in White City or Junction City. And because of the moderation in the forecast, we believe that the prison currently under construction in Madras, the Deer Ridge Correctional Institution, which the legislature gave kind of final forward approval on in the last legislative session, because of that moderation in the forecast, Deer Ridge will fill up slower than had been anticipated and allow us to put off the need to fund and go forward immediately with the full build of the next facility. That really has an impact in two significant ways. The first is that it puts off the need to finance the full cost of that prison, which slows down the impact on the debt service and its addition to the general fund. The other positive part of that is that if we're going to open that facility 2 years later than we thought we were going to have to, the startup and operational costs associated with that 2 years are not going to fall into this or even fully into the next biennium. So we're one of the few agencies, I think, that can come forward and say a downturn in our forecast is actually good news. We do think it's good news. This gives you a sense in the next slide of what drives prison population. And it's the number of inmates times the length of the sentence. And obviously changes in sentencing law really have a substantial impact on what that ultimately means. It's also, I think, important to understand, however, that it's not just changes in the law around sentencing, but oftentimes changes in practice can have as much impact. If, for example, we're going to target or communities choose to target a particular kind of crime and they devote those law enforcement resources to that issue, it could have the impact of putting more people in the system even though the law hasn't actually changed. And I know many of you have been through a recent skit that sort of demonstrated the hydraulic effect and the interrelationship of all of those criminal justice entities, and this is just one more, I think, proof of that point. The next slide just gives you a brief history of Oregon's sentencing policy. Pre-1989, we were a parole system with indeterminate sentencing where a sentence could be for a long period of time, but the determination of whether or how long a person served was determined by the parole board. That changed in 1989 when the legislature adopted sentencing guidelines, and that created a grid system with boxes that could vary inside the box, but was obviously more determinate than the prior system. And then that had a substantial change in 1994 when the voters passed Measure 11 that created mandatory minimum sentencing for 21 specific violent crimes. Since then, there's also been a repeat property offender statute adopted, which creates a presumptive prison sentence for individuals who have committed a certain number of repeat or property offenses and have those predicate acts. And then in the last special session in 2006, Jessica's Law, which isn't obviously going to have any immediate impact given the length of sentence those people are serving, but as it takes a sentence and elongates on the back end how much time someone will serve, years down the road you'll be able to see the impacts of those sentences as they play out. And that's just, again, I think, an important hydraulic to understand about how DOC operates and how those sentences work. To the extent we're taking somebody who is going to serve 5 years and we add 5 years onto the back end of that sentence, you really won't see the stacking effect of that impact until 5 years out, and those people then who would have otherwise released to the community start serving their 6th and 7th and 8th and 9th and 10th years. And that's been the impact, obviously, with Measure 11. Most of the crimes under Measure 11 would have resulted in a prison sentence. It elongated the period of time for how long those people would be in prison, and that's where you start to see the impact on the population. I also listed under the history of Measure 11 not only its approval and what it does, but if you'll turn to the next page, those are the current Measure 11 crimes. And I don't want to go, obviously, we don't need to talk about all of them in detail, but I think it's unfair to have this conversation without also pointing out that there have been adjustments to Measure 11 over the time since its inception. And briefly on the following slide, you'll just see what those were. In 95, there were some additions. In 97, there were some additions as well as some departures in 99, so you'll just see a kind of a running history of the impacts there. And if you'd like more information on that, we'd be happy to provide it and share sort of more of that history with you. The next slide, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is one that's prepared, again, by the Office of Economic Analysis, not by the department, and it attempts to capture the impact of Measure 11 specifically simply because of its size and the impact that it had on the system over time. Before the black line separating the two parts of that graph is the historical data, so you can see sort of what has happened since its inception. And then obviously on the right side of that line you see then the forecast of what the impact is anticipated to be. To give you just a little bit, the darker shaded area are the direct impacts and the lighter are the indirect. Best way for me to describe that is the direct impacts are the ones where someone actually has been sentenced to a Measure 11 sentence. The indirect impacts are best described, I think, as individuals who were charged with a Measure 11 sentence but pled to something lesser than a Measure 11 sentence but got more time than they would have otherwise gotten prior to the passage of Measure 11. The forecaster has a pretty good model for identifying who those are and how many those are. And that's just essentially an effort to capture the fact that because Measure 11 can have a substantial impact on an individual's sentence, there is an indirect impact in non-Measure 11 crimes and how they're sentenced. The small black line obviously just demonstrates from the last forecast to this one, some additional projections in the out years for an increase as it's currently being anticipated by the forecast in Measure 11 sentences. It's not a significant one, but it is a bit of an upward tick. The next slide just shows you the state of Oregon and where our 13 operating facilities are located. Our one under construction is currently identified right in the middle of the state, Deer Ridge in Madras, and then the two in parentheses are Junction City and White City, and those are land that was identified in 1995 by the Governor's Prison Siting Advisory Committee. Those lands were purchased at that time and remain sort of in the DOC stockpile under our supervision for future expansion and construction. Next slide just shows you a bit of a chronology of prison construction in Oregon. In 1866, we start with the Oregon State Penitentiary. Those of you who visited would wonder if it's changed at all since 1866. I can assure you that it has in a number of ways, and I don't think any of the original buildings are still standing. I think some of our oldest buildings there date back to near the turn of the century, but nothing dating back before the turn of the century at this point. I understand that the wall was even in some places in a bit of a different location, and Mill Creek used to run through the middle of the penitentiary. It doesn't now. You can see then the other construction, pretty limited construction and not much going on until in the early 90s, and then obviously a substantial amount of construction after 1995. And to give you just a sense of how we do this, we really do try to tie our construction plan and our long-term construction plan to population forecasts. We don't want to build a prison that we don't need. We also don't want to be in a situation where we need a prison that we haven't built. The challenge associated with that is that from the time we get the approval to go forward until the time we can actually start operating the facility is about a 4 to 5 year window, which means, given the size of the institutions, which really means that we are having to have a fair amount of confidence in the forecast, because any significant changes in the forecast could put you behind the eight ball one way or the other. And so that's always a bit of a concern for me as we're trying to make decisions about what to put forward in the long-term plan for the system. The legislature has on several occasions delayed construction of facilities. They delayed back when I was involved in probably voting in favor of the delay, the Warner Creek facility that we completed and operate now in Lakeview, and then again in the 2003 timeframe, we delayed going forward with the construction of Deer Ridge, and then the legislature addressed that one in the last session. Those delays required us to crowd people inside our current system, also required us to use some amount of in-state rental beds to address the population growth without the appropriate bed space, and required us to add both temporary and emergency beds in a number of facilities throughout the system. Obviously, I've talked a little bit about the upside of those delays because it did, you know, certainly cause us to be a little bit further down on assuming debt service and the operational cost of those facilities. The next slide gives you a short list of each of the institutions. There wasn't enough room in the box to give you all of their names, but if you think that something has the name creek or river associated with it, you're going to be right about 85% of the time. So if it's a C or an R, that's typically what that's standing for. But that gives you just a shorthand version of the institutions, the date they were opened or had an expansion, their location, the custody type of inmates that we house in those facilities, and a bed capacity number as well. On a one sheet. What I don't intend to do is to walk you through each individual prison, but behind that slide is an individual slide for each of the individual facilities that gives you a little more detail on the history of the facility, the size of the facility, and then the variety of programs issues that we address, the type of facility that operates, and I won't walk you through each one of those individually. I do want to just briefly pause on page 16 of your presentation on the Deer Ridge facility that's under construction right now in Madras. This is a co-located facility, and it's currently being constructed and is on time and budget. That facility will have 432 beds of minimum custody, but it also will include 212 beds of minimum custody beds that are treatment beds. These are 53-bed treatment units designed for intensive A&D and co-occurring disorder, so alcohol and drug and co-occurring disorder treatment. And I point that out to you, if only to sort of underscore a point. These are the first treatment design beds that the Department of Corrections has constructed in the last 7,000 beds of prison construction in Oregon. So we were very appreciative of the governor and legislative leadership for the authorization to convert these beds into targeted treatment units where we can actually put on the kind of evidence-based alcohol and drug and mental health treatment programs in a way that we think are going to be extremely effective. And we really believe these are going to be very cost-effective beds when one considers the impact on recidivism that these individuals will have having gone through that treatment. And I'll share some demographic data with you briefly that talks about sort of our needs on both those areas. But I did want to point out that since 1990, we haven't really constructed any treatment space within the department, and this would be the first time where we have these kinds of beds. So I will skip those pages that have an individual institution identified. If you have any questions about any of those specific institutions, we'd be more than happy to talk to you about them. Would invite you to visit any of them that you'd like to visit. I know a number of you have been to the penitentiary and to our facility at Coffee Creek that's in Wilsonville, which is the female facility and our intake facility. But beyond that, if there are any of the others here in the Salem area during the session that you might like to visit, or any around the state, would be honored to have you come. We think that instead of me blabbing at you for multiple days in committee, a tour and some time at the facility actually is a pretty worthwhile event. I'll probably blab at you there too, but you'll at least get the visual of what's going on. The next area is just some DOC demographics that we thought would share with you as to the population that we're dealing with. 92% of our population are men, 8% are women. You can see the ratio. I think it is interesting to point out that the female population has doubled in the last 15 years. I thought that was interesting enough that I included a slide just on the growth of the female population in that next slide. And you'll see a pretty good spike right around that 2001-2002 time frame. I'll have to acknowledge some personal responsibility for that. The judiciary committees in the legislature at the time agreed, as did the rest of the legislature, that it made sense to take the serious crime of identity theft and add it to the repeat property offender statute. And so we did that. What I don't think most of us anticipated, and I know that the department didn't specifically anticipated, was that there were a number of women who, driven by their methamphetamine addiction, had used and continue to use identity theft as sort of their crime of choice in feeding their addiction. And so you can see a substantial, Sue Porter's forecast from DAS, impact on the timing around that decision and the substantial increase in the number of women that came into the system. And I'm not
pejoratively saying that was a bad thing because the crime was obviously being committed. But it was an unanticipated thing, specifically as to the female population. And I think that just is a, for me, it was a personal living example, having now touched both sides of that equation, is to try to understand what the impacts are going to be when we make those kinds of choices. What that drove for us was moving in the last legislative session an expansion package through at Coffee Creek, where the legislature approved adding an additional 216 medium custody beds at that facility and 108 beds of minimum custody at that facility, which builds that site out to its total rated capacity. So those construction projects, the minimum is completed, the medium at Coffee Creek is still under construction but will be completed shortly, and once done, that will then be the maximum amount of space we have at that facility, and there is no more room to build there. And that's about, under the original forecasting models that we were looking at least 4 years ahead of time when we had anticipated needing to make those decisions. So that just gives you some impact of how the process works. The next slide just gives you a brief shot at age groups throughout the system. I think it is important just to point here that in doing our work, that 46 to 60 and 61 and older population is growing pretty dramatically within the department. So as a rule, the age issue is becoming a more significant issue for us as we attempt to operate. You'll hear me say probably several times during the session that our doctors tell us that an inmate physiologically is about 15 years older than he is chronologically, given the way they've lived their lives and not a lot of effort around preventative care and a lot of bad choices about how they spent their free time and the kinds of things they put into their body. And as we have seen with a number of crimes, and I'll make a point on this as we look at crime types in a minute, we have seen that population grow. And I believe that in the 5 years projected, we'll double the number of inmates that we have over the age of 55, which is really for us like doubling the number of inmates we have over the ages of 70. And so that creates some substantial burden on the healthcare delivery system inside the department. And to give you just a sense of the size of the healthcare delivery system inside the department, and I know this isn't a full-on budget presentation, so I have to be careful not running too far afoul of Mr. Wilson's directions, but so you understand the range of that, we're spending about $125 million on just healthcare delivery inside the DOC alone. So that gives you some impact. And one of the big drivers over time is going to be that older, aging population inside the system and how we're required, obviously, to care for them under our constitutional obligations. Next slide just gives you a breakdown on the population by race. The percentages for the primary minority groups as compared to the overall population by crime type, which shows you that almost 70% of those that we have incarcerated have committed some person crime. It's not a statute crime and it's not a property crime, but they've committed some person crime that's where the individual victim has been victimized by that type of crime. And if you'll look at the very next slide, we've broken it out by offense type, and you'll see the varying categories of offense, the big hitters obviously being things like robbery and assault and homicide. I'd point out for you as well that if you add up the three categories that are listed as sex-related crimes, sodomy, sex abuse, and rape, that's 27% of the population. So about 27% of the entire prison population has committed some level of a sex offense that's gotten them in for longer than 12 months on a felony crime. Then you see the other categories and some of the smaller ones identified off to your right. Next is demographic by mental health need, and I share this with you just to underscore the ongoing challenge we have in the department. Many of the folks who come in, as you'll see there, have some need for mental health treatment. The highest need in our severe problem group make up almost 20% of the population of the department. Add that to the moderate need group, and these are all people who are both being treated likely by pharmacological approaches, so drugs being prescribed, but also in those categories, this is where they're having some regular contact with a mental health provider, whether that's a psychiatrist, a psychologist, or some other mental health trained individual that's having some regular contact. For some of those, it could be daily contact. For others, it's weekly. For others, it might just be monthly. But these are people who have been diagnosed under the DSM approach with a mental health issue and are then needing that kind of level of mental health treatment. I'll just make a side note that it's substantially higher among the female population. Almost 50% of those incarcerated at Coffee Creek, the women, come in and fit into those three categories in the female population. So there's a much higher need for mental health services among the female population, but a broad mental health need among the male population as well. Next slide is just the substance abuse need broken down. And again, you can, as would be no surprise, I'm sure, to any of you, whether it's moderate, severe addiction or a severe problem, a large majority of the department inmates that are housed in the department have some substance abuse need and would benefit from treatment. I want to just take a couple of minutes, and I know I'm running short on time, Mr. Chairman, and I'll try to wrap this up, just to give you a brief rundown on community corrections, because it's such a significant part of what we do and our partnership with our county community corrections partners. This just gives you a brief history. The first Community Corrections Act was passed in 1977. Counties at that time had an option about what kind of county they wanted to be, and they could choose to have the state run their system, or the county could choose to run its own system. And that process continued until 1995 with the passage of Senate Bill 1145, the Community Corrections Act. And at that point, a couple of things happened. The state gave back to the counties the responsibility of providing the supervisory responsibilities. The state also at that point said that an offender who is going to be serving 12 months or less will serve their time in a county jail. If they were going to go to prison, they're now going to serve that time in county jail, and that's typically called the local control population. So those things happened in 1995. And as part of the process or the arrangement that was made, the state did take on jail expansion, work release center expansion, and other projects with the individual counties who could come forward and ask for assistance. And the state invested $97.5 million in COP funding for jail and space expansion with the counties around the state. So you understand the impact of that. DOC is continuing to pay in my general fund budget, in that little sliver on that 10% sliver on debt service, about $16 million of that debt service continues to pay the debt service on the state's investment in those county facilities. So that gives you just a brief picture on that. If you go to that next slide that's blank, and I apologize that it's blank, I wasn't able to get this slide in the presentation, but in your packet you'll have a slide that looks like this. That is the community corrections population forecast. It works very much like the prison population forecast and is done at the same time. That forecast will just simply show you that while the prison population forecast is moderated most recently, the community corrections local supervision population forecast has actually gone up, and those numbers are reflected on that slide. To give you some sense of how that works, if you look in the next slide, you'll see that there are about 33,000 people currently around the state under supervision by the counties in those county community corrections offices. 20,000 of them are on felony probation, so they haven't come to prison, and they wouldn't typically come to prison given the crimes. They're sentenced to felony probation. They've got a probation/parole officer person who serves that function in the county and supervises them. 13,000 of them are on post-prison supervision. Those are people who've been in the prison system and have returned, and for some period of time following their release are going to serve with their parole, probation, post-prison supervision officer. That person monitors their terms and conditions and can violate them if they violate those terms and either put them back in jail or have them participate in some sort of other approach. And then the last little category there, that 1,203, is the local control population. And that's the population that I want you to understand, is that's the group that is convicted of a felony. They're going to go to jail, and they're serving that 12 months or less time in a county jail facility somewhere around the state. And prior to 1145, that 1,203 would have come into the Department of Corrections and occupied a prison bed. Just to give you one more snapshot of how that works out, this is the DOC and community corrections population broken down. So you'll see that of all of that felony population that is under some level of supervision, you have 24% that are in a DOC facility, 2% in local control at the county level, 22% under post-prison supervision. You can see the felony probation and the jail and work release beds and how many people are serving and those kinds of. And then we broke it out the two counties that we actually operate those agencies directly from DOC as well, just to give you a picture. But that really gives you a picture of kind of how the felony supervision population is broken down around the state. I've just put a couple of comments about in here about why we believe the community corrections system currently works and why it's important to allow for the counties and those local public safety coordinating councils to play a significant role in designing and defining how that kind of a system is going to work in their individual counties. We really do believe that local control operated by those counties with those partners is the best way to actually provide that level of supervision and to make those choices. So the formula provides resources to the county, but we don't really tell the county specifically how to divide that money up. They work collectively as a group to ultimately decide how they're going to allocate those resources among those various supervisory functions. And then my last slide is just simply to point out that as it relates to all of this, it's all a function of what's currently happening. And the best we can typically do is forecast current law. Any law changes or significant practice changes can have a huge impact on changing the long-term forecast. And there are clearly issues out there that are pending, whether it's new legislation that people have currently filed that you might have the opportunity at some point to review, or even some citizen-driven initiatives that are currently being qualified for the ballot right now. One of them, which would be a repeat property or a mandatory sentences for property offenders, all of those things can have an impact long term on the numbers and the information that we provided you here, and would welcome an opportunity to talk to you about any of your specific questions around those areas when the timing is appropriate. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I know that I ran through those quickly and I'm cognizant of the time, but I'd be pleased to respond to any specific questions, or as all I believe all the committee members know, if you have specific questions that we can answer, just please don't hesitate to contact me, and we'll be trying to get around and visit just briefly with each of you prior to the beginning of our full budget presentation later in February.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Now, he's going to be back shortly to talk about budget considerations, so if you have some budget issues that could wait, that would be wonderful, but any questions for Max? Senator Nelson. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions I asked yesterday is that if we hire 136 new state patrol guys, do you have any way of measuring your women?
I didn't say that. I said 139.
I'm just very sensitive.
Patrol persons.
I know. You're a good guy. Measuring what that impact will actually show up as far as your the prison forecast would be.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, you know, I think that that's something that would certainly be taken into consideration in the forecast modeling as we talk about changes in the system. I don't know how refined I don't know how specifically refined that would show up in the forecast. My experience in just conversations I've had with a number of law enforcement agencies around the state, it's hard to go out and hire 139 new patrol officers, whether you're the City of Portland or the Oregon State Police, in sort of a one moment in time. And so my guess is that while that would have a cumulative impact over time as they kind of ramped up and put those people through the academy and brought them on, you probably wouldn't see a real obvious immediate impact longer term, and certainly targeted areas. If it was going to be if there were going to be a whole bunch of people targeting drug offenses, for example, I think you might be able to get a little closer to saying, okay, you know, how many meth meth labs, how many, and get some better data. People on the road, I think the best statistic we're probably going to see is, if it's consistent with everything I've read, a downturn in the number of fatalities and people slowing down as they're moving up and down the freeway, if they have a belief that 8 or 9 miles down the road somebody's sitting at an off-ramp potentially with their radar gun out. So I think we'll see that kind of an impact a lot sooner than we'll probably see it demonstrate something in the forecast.
Just one more follow-up.
Follow-up, Senator Nelson.
For information I'll need sometime down the line, I've got two prisons in my district, and one of them is really concerned about staffing and vacation times, and you've probably heard some of those things, but some of that information I'm going to need is they're basically two rivers saying they're not. Some of the younger guys or younger staff members aren't getting any vacation time, and so is there some sort of comparison between institutions or something I can get?
Again, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, probably unbeknownst to you, but to your legislative assistant, I think we have a meeting on Thursday where I think we're going to try to answer some of your questions on that issue, and we'll share some of that information. Obviously, vacation bidding and the like is governed to some degree by the collective bargaining agreements with the various unions that are represented in the institutions, but we've been working with them on that issue, and we'll provide you some information and let you understand sort of the issue that we're addressing and how we're trying to approach it.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say, I recently was on the tour up at Coffee Creek, and I've been on a few other tours with Mr. Williams, and your hands-on approach, I think, is really good. I noticed that staff at all levels seems to know you. You inquire how they're doing, and you know about their families and things, and I think that's really important. You put a real human touch on that, and I think you're doing a great job.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Representative Barker. Particularly today, I appreciate
it. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you. I have two questions. One is on page 9. It's about prison population forecasting. And I was looking quickly at the composition of the Forecast Advisory Committee, and I understand this is out of your purview. It happens somewhere else. But I wonder if you have a very short comment on this. When we look at trying to forecast prison population, one of the things that I'm very interested in is investing in education and health care to avoid continuing the upswing in prison population. I'd rather treat people ahead of time than later and invest in people. So to that extent, I was sort of interested in thinking about, gee, there's no participation in this advisory committee by the education community, health, job training in particular. Where does job training fit into this? Is this something that you've ever discussed in a general sense? Why don't we see something here?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nathanson, I appreciate the question. The Forecast Advisory Committee, because the forecasts are typically trying to shoot sort of in two-year increments, by and large, this group is really trying to provide the forecasting folks sort of what's currently happening in the late-breaking trends about how people who are committing crimes are being processed and handled through the system. I believe later in the month we're going to have an opportunity to see a presentation that really talks about sort of a portfolio approach to service delivery that talks about some of the intervention issues that I think you're really raising and where that really fits in broadly to the system for long-term planning and really decision-making and investments and investment opportunities, I think, from the legislature to try to kind of get into this conversation. And I think that'll be a great conversation and one that I'm pleased to continue to engage with you on. But I really think that hasn't been much of a focus of this group simply because really they're trying to tell the person who's got to go back and crunch the numbers for the next forecast, is there some recent court decision or some lack of in 2003, for example, when we what was it between 2001 and 2003, the special sessions where we continued to come back in and reduce the budget and reduce services. This group was providing information about, well, DAs in this county aren't doing these kinds of crimes anymore and won't be doing them until there's some additional money restored. It was really that real-time data that they were trying to use to anticipate impacts on the forecast. But I fully agree with you, the need for the long-term look, and I really think that presentation on the 30th will give us kind of the starting point for that conversation.
Great. The second one can be shorter and can be a response some other day. I just don't know when to bring it up. It was quite striking when you mentioned on page 26 the demographics by mental health need, and you pointed out a very striking difference between the mental health needs of women versus men. I'd like to hear at the appropriate time more about that.
We'd be pleased to do that when we arrange a time to come visit you personally as well. And if other committee members would like us to address a little bit more on that issue, we'll be happy to work with the chair to make sure that's part of any presentation we make.
Thank you. We're running late on time. We'll one more question from Senator Brown. And
one more. Okay, I'm going to do two combined in one question to follow up on Representative Nathan's question. I'd heard that California predicts their prison population by looking at literacy rates in the third grade, and I don't know if that's something that would take in the long term plus the prevention angle. The other piece is how successful have been the prisons around the state in terms of ability to attract qualified staff, staff happiness, and economic development issues. Have those been successful? And then just, I'd also be curious about culturally appropriate and gender-specific services for your next presentation. So,
happy to get all three of those. And I assume you want us to come back and talk to you about that.
That's great.
Okay. Thank you, Senator. Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Mr. Williams, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the committee's time.
Next up is Mr. Jester.
Chair Shields, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I'm the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And as, like Mr. Williams, I'd like to go through a PowerPoint that you have in front of you, which is an overview at a high level of the Oregon Youth Authority. And I'd like to hit on a couple of policy issues that we'd like to explore in more depth when we return the 1st of March with our presentation. If you turn to page 2 of your handout, you will see the mission and statutory authority of the Oregon Youth Authority as established in 1995 through Senate Bill 1 and is codified in the 420A section. On page 3, you will see our mission statement is to protect the public, reduce crime by holding youth offenders accountable, and providing opportunities for reformation in safe environments. And we have a list of our values. One is excellence in public service, partnerships with local communities, openness and accountability, and services in a respectful and humane manner. On page 4, you will see a brief history of the Oregon Youth Authority. In 1994, Governor Roberts asked Attorney General Kulongowski to put together a task force to look at the reforms in juvenile justice across the state of Oregon. And at that point in time, the system was underfunded and truly was broken. There was no accountability for youth offenders, and the crime rate with the advent of youth gangs coming to the state of Oregon was high. The recommendation after almost a year of work and 700 people being involved in various subcommittees working with then Attorney General Kulongowski was Senate Bill 1, which put the Oregon Youth Authority as an independent department, removing it from the Department of Human Resources, where it had previously been housed as a program area within the Children's Services Division. The reason was to administer corrections facilities and a multi-tiered system of services and sanctions across the state of Oregon, starting and ending at the community level. The Oregon Youth Authority serves offenders age 12 to 25. We exercise legal and physical custody of youth offenders who are committed by juvenile courts, and we exercise the physical custody of offenders committed to the Department of Corrections and transferred to the Oregon Youth Authority for housing in a youth correctional facility if the offense occurred prior to the offender's 18th birthday. On page 5, you will see a schematic that shows the case management model in the Oregon Youth Authority and the continuum of services and sanctions that I described as the core foundation of Senate Bill 1. It's important for me to note for you that on the left-hand side, you will see outside that continuum, 18,000 young people in the state of Oregon are dealt with at the local level by local juvenile departments. And these are youth who have not yet risen to the level of needing state intervention, but nonetheless are part of the juvenile justice system in the state of Oregon. The continuum of case management starts with probation, where we have 350 residential care beds and another 300 youth that are on probation being supervised in their homes. We have the OYA facility services in the middle of that continuum, and then we have the parole services on the back end. We have a comparison between the 057 legislatively approved budget and the 0709 governor's recommended budget, and the detail of those increases I will get to at the end of this presentation. But suffice to say that there is an increase of 73 beds on the community side and 145 beds on the custody side. And these beds are restoration of capacity that was lost during the 03 recession, and the governor's recommending that those be put back online. On page 6, we have an offender profile looking at the differences both in the criminal characteristics and the social characteristics, and I have broken this out by gender to make a couple of important points. When you look at the male offenses, the top left, you will see that 40% first line of the males that we manage in the youth authority have been committed for a sex offense. Correspondingly, on the female side, 6%. When you drop down three lines to person offenses, which in this category is assault, 14%, young women 29%, almost twice the number of assaultive behavior incidents by young women. When you look at substance abuse on the male side, you look at 3% have been committed for substance or alcohol related law violations. However, on the young women's side, we have four times that rate, or 12%, have been committed for substance or alcohol related criminal offenses. But the more revealing part of the profile and the differences between the males and the females that are managed in the Oregon Youth Authority and the juvenile justice system in the state of Oregon is on the bottom portion of the page under social characteristics. Males, we have 3/4 who have alcohol or drug use as a primary precipitating problem. Females, you will see, is almost 100% of the young women that we manage have alcohol or substance abuse as a primary precipitating problem. Diagnosed mental health disorders. Mr. Williams talked about the difference between males and females and also adult and juveniles. In the male side, almost 2/3 have a diagnosed mental health illness. On the female side, almost 3/4, 77%, have a diagnosed mental health illness. When you look at youth who have been sexually abused, 1/3, 31% of the boys, 57%, over half the young women that we manage have been sexually abused. Pardon me. If you would turn to page 7, we look at the evidence-based services. Senate Bill 267 in 2003 passed, and the Oregon Youth Authority has emphasized its continued commitment to effective services and implementation of evidence-based interventions in all of our programs that we either provide or that we contract for. And we have done this through the implementation of a standard risk need assessment that every youth offender receives upon commitment to the youth authority, and that drives the case plan. We then have adopted and implemented evidence-based treatment curriculum in our facilities, and we have organized our facility programs to focus on areas of specific youth risk and need. We have collaborated with our partners both at the county level and in the private nonprofit sector where we contract for their programs to be evidence-based interventions as well. We have provided technical assistance, and we have provided training both to our staff and community partners to achieve the goal of evidence-based, research-based program to achieve the outcomes that we want, which is a reduction in further criminality. We have assessed all Oregon Youth Authority and community contracted programs by using quality assurance measures and outcomes. To date, the Oregon Youth Authority has exceeded the statutory requirement of 25% of state funds spent on programs that are subject to 267. We have 47% of those programs that are subject to 267 are evidence-based this biennium, and that's of $60 million of our budget. So $60 million of our budget is subject to the provisions of Senate Bill 267, and 47% of those dollars currently are being spent on evidence-based programs throughout the continuum of juvenile justice. We take this very seriously. Case planning, I mentioned, this is really the foundation following the risk need assessment, is to put together a plan for what that youth offender, what the risk need area that youth offender is going to be targeted, and how we're going to accomplish that. And you will see that it is based on the risk need assessment, that it is a structured and consistent method to evaluate the progress of youth offenders as they move through our system. This is both in the community and within our facilities. It focuses on the greatest risk that that youth offender has for future criminality. We track the progress of youth toward achieving their long-term goals, and there is just a box on the side that shows you what that case plan document in our juvenile justice information system looks like. Treatment and reformation programs at the bottom of the page. Reformation opportunities are provided through a variety of treatment services and programs, education programs, and vocational training programs. These are a combination of programs that are provided both by youth authority staff and by contracted staff. And we will spend more time on this list during our budget presentation and talk about the tie between these programs, what they are designed to target, what the evidence is, and their reducing criminality, and how we show the increase in outcomes by the implementation of these programs. But a couple I'd like to talk about. We have established a core cognitive curriculum that we're using in all of our facility programs now, along with alcohol and drug treatment, mental health treatment, gang intervention, sex offender treatment, and specific treatment for young women's transition. And we look forward to developing a gender-specific facility as part of the governor's recommended budget for 07-09. On page 9, you will see the Oregon Juvenile Justice Information System, commonly known as JAGIS. The vision of JAGIS was to provide a comprehensive information system about juvenile offenders across the state of Oregon, including the 36 counties and the state's Oregon Youth Authority. There are 37 users. This one-stop shopping provides information that is reliable, consistent, and comparable statewide. It is a foundation for planning and development and evaluation on the core purpose of the juvenile justice system in Oregon, which is, in fact, to reduce juvenile crime. It produces high-quality reports that we can look at referrals to juvenile departments, secure detention, recidivism, restitution, and community service, and demographic information on all the offenders that are being managed in juvenile justice across the state. On page 10, you will see our facility and transition programs. The Oregon Youth Authority operates 6 youth correctional facilities and 4 transition programs, which are located in communities across the state. The youth correctional facilities are the highest level of security and reformation services. They are divided into living units housing 25 youth offenders, and the reformation and services within those facilities are provided by a combination of Oregon Youth Authority and contract provider staff. Transition programs are a bridge from the correctional youth facilities to placement in the community. These programs continue the focus on reformation services, education, and vocational skill building. They center around supervised work crews, local employment, community service projects, accountability through payment of restitution to victims and the community. On page 10, you will see a map and the location of our facilities. We have grayed out the Oak Creek Youth Correctional Facility in Albany. This is a 75-bed secure correctional facility that is part of the governor's recommended budget to reopen, and it will be developed and centered around a gender-specific program for young women. On page 12, we address the community services. Case management of youth offenders is focused on the goal of protecting the public by reducing the risk of future criminal activity. This service includes both supervision and is supported by a continuum of both services and sanctions. The Oregon Youth Authority community services are provided through partnerships in the community with the utilization of best practices. We maintain co-management agreements with the 36 counties across the state, and I think this is an important element of our partnerships with local juvenile departments and county government. Rather than the state going into a community and providing a set of services and hoping that we hit the mark in terms of where there may be gaps at the local level, we actually sit down and negotiate what we bring to the table, what the county has at the table, and how we can make that continuum make sense at the local level. And it isn't the same across the state of Oregon. There are some urban counties that may have detention and other kinds of resources where there are some rural counties that may not have that same resource. And so the state wants to bring that resource into those communities and create that balance for equal access for all youth in the state to appropriate services. We support the rights of victims, and we support families with the coordination of services at the local level. And we work with partners always toward the eye of continued improvement in the system. If you look at the pie chart on the right-hand side of page 12, you will see that 21% of the funds in the community services pay for the case management supervision by our parole and probation staff and support. And 79% of the investment goes into direct services for clients at the local level. On page 13, we talk about the Oregon Youth Authority system of performance measures and management. Oregon Youth Authority's performance and management system has several components. The key performance measures, which consist of intermediate outcomes, support the agency's mission of youth safety through the measurement of injuries, suicide attempts, runaways, accountability through the measurement of restitution and risk need assessments, and reformation, which measures intake, case planning, education, treatment, transition, and most importantly, recidivism, which we will talk about. Performance-based standards. Oregon is one of the states that participates nationally in a project of performance-based standards that measures 100 components in facility operations centered around safety, order, security, health and mental health services, reintegration, and it is a process of data collection every 6 months, and we measure the baseline of each facility and then the improvement within each facility. We can now drill down to the unit level, and we can drill down to the program level. We are also beginning that process and looking at how we can implement a similar standard in the community and in the field. Our safety and security reviews. This is a high priority for the Youth Authority to have safe environments for youth offenders, our staff, and communities. Our field and facilities have a structured safety and security review process, which is conducted by staff within the Oregon Youth Authority. We have subscribed, along with adult corrections, to the correctional program checklist. I think many of you have heard Dr. Latessa present from University of Cincinnati. He is the founder, the author of the community programs checklist. We have used that. We use that instrument in all of our close custody programs, and our community contracted programs have all undergone the CPC, which has then resulted in our data collection on programs that have met the threshold of 267. We subscribe to a continuous quality improvement model. We have a formal quality improvement system within the Oregon Youth Authority, which constantly monitors and has oversight over agency operations. We have an oversight committee that collects data, analyzes the data for high-risk problem areas, and then we develop ongoing improvement plans to address those areas of high risk and reduce them. Oregon's performance measurement system is supported by the Juvenile Justice Information System, which provides currently 300 reports on a monthly basis that are available to staff and stakeholders to basically drill down and look at data and information about the youth that are part of the juvenile justice system across the state, again with the 37 users. On page 14, there is a preview of our recidivism data, which I wanted to share with you. We were asked by the Oregon Legislature to develop a recidivism measure comparable to that of the Adult Corrections Department, and therefore we have used data from both the Juvenile Justice Information System and the Department of Corrections Information System to crosswalk those individuals. What we are looking for as a is a consideration of a juvenile adjudication of a felony or adult conviction of a felony as the indicator of recidivism. So it is a new felony that's been committed by either a youth or an adult that leaves our system. We track youth offenders at 12, 24, and 36 months. We look at probation, parole, and the DOC population separately. So we look at the three separate groups of population. We look at those groups 12, 24, and 36 months out. So to give you an example, in the top box we have probation. These are youth committed to OYA for probation during a fiscal year, and they are tracked from the point that they are committed to the Oregon Youth Authority. So they come into our commitment. Remember that they're in the community. They may be in an out-of-home care, residential, treatment, foster care placement, and we track from the time we get them. 12 months out, we take a look. 24 months out, we take a look. And 36 months out, we take a look to see if there has been a new adjudicated or conviction of a felony law violation. In 2000-2001 fiscal year, we had 677 youth in that cohort. In 12 months, we had 14.2% who had committed an additional felony law violation. At 24 months, we had 22.9%. And at 36 months, we had 31%. This data nationally compares extremely favorably for the programs that the Oregon Youth Authority manages and that we work with in conjunction with local communities. If you look at the most recent data for that same cohort of probation, in fiscal year 2004-05, we received 447 youth on probation. That's the size of the cohort. And at 12 months out, we have a 9.6 recidivism rate, which shows the decrease from 01 to 05. Similarly, in the bottom box, you will see the data for parole. However, it is different from the point of tracking. Because they are committed to us to be placed in a secure youth correctional facility, we do not track from the time of commitment, but we track from the time of release back to the community. So when the youth returns to community for the first time, the clock starts. We look 12, 24, 36 months back. We'll use the same time period. 2000 to 2001, we placed 412 youth into the community. And at 12 months, we had a 13.3. 24 months, we had a 25.5. And at 36 months, we had a 35.7. If you drop down to 0-4-5, which is our latest data, we have 313 youth who have left our secure facilities return to the community. At the point of community placement, we start the clock. We've looked back 12 months. We have an 8.9% recidivism rate, or a new adjudicated or conviction of felony law violation for that cohort. That is extremely good data in a juvenile justice system. And we attribute the decrease, as you look across the continuum, to the implementation of evidence-based best practices, that we believe that there is a correlation between the kind of programs that are being provided within the youth authority, within our contracted providers, and by local counties in the way they manage and work with youth offenders. And we believe that this is showing up in that data. On page 15, we just have a snapshot of view of the governor's recommended budget. And the pie chart, upper left-hand side of the page, you will see that 52% of the general fund is directed toward our facilities, 34% is directed toward our community services, and the other areas of program support, agency-wide, debt service, and capital improvements make up the addition of 100% of that general fund budget. This budget, governor's recommended budget, does include the restoration of 145 beds in close custody. You may recall that during the 2003 recession, we did close 200 beds in close custody. And of those 200, 145 are on the table for restoration. And I have advised the governor that when we reopen the youth correctional facility in Oak Creek, that we need to develop a best practices national model to be followed by other states of gender-specific programming for young women. And that is our intention, to convert Oak Creek into a gender-specific facility for young women and couple it with our transition program of Corvallis House, which is a transition program for young women that we currently operate in Corvallis. On the page 16, the last page, there is budget detail, which we will spend more time with when we come back in March, and would be happy to answer any questions that folks may have about the Youth Authority, about juvenile justice in the state of Oregon, or the materials presented.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, first of all, nice today that it's not your agency in the spotlight. As last session, you know that feeling, so I'm sure you feel for Director Williams and his position today. One of the more impressive tours, members, I just relate this, that I took during the last session happened to be through the OIA facility. And as it relates to the work they've done in recidivism and measuring recidivism, one of the tours was through part of the high school program at
McLaren.
And to see kids in a different learning environment, different than what we might typically recognize as a high school program, but somewhat of a military-looking program. But the results that came from that seemed to be just extraordinary. As we go further into looking at recidivism, I'm wondering if there will be a way to measure the difference between the folks that were in your authority, within your authority, who received a high school diploma. Can we measure them out of this recidivism rate? In other words, can we drill down into recidivism and see, of those that were in your authority when they received a high school diploma, what does their rate look like compared to those who either you didn't have in custody long enough or they didn't complete a program? What would that look like? Can we get there? Not today, probably, but if you can break it down, I'd like to understand that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, thank you, number one, for the kind words. And yes, it is nice not to be in the spotlight today. we will absolutely take a look and see if we can separate. That information exists in JGIS, and we do put educational information in there, and we will have our folks in research begin looking at that so we can get you some good data on that. One of the things that we do know about the education programs in our close custody facilities, and true also of the programs in our residential providers, is that we hear from the teachers that are working in those programs that it is so nice to come into a classroom where you are assured that the youth does not have a weapon, you are assured the youth is not high on drugs, you know that they've had, you know, 8 to 10 hours of sleep and 3 meals a day, and that family issues are not the most compelling thing on that youth offender's mind when they enter the classroom. And it makes a significant difference in their attention span and their ability to get through the coursework that results in diploma.
Sure. Would you allow me just to follow up here? I don't want to take this too long, but every one of us, I'm sure, at one time or another, wonder how you spend the money up front versus the money down the road. I mean, we're going to face that in so many venues in this building. This program, I'll tell you, when you visit with the kids that were in the program, with the principal, I don't know if she's the same one still there or not, and the teachers that were there, you realize that so many of the environmental problems that the kids who were there are from out beyond their control. And when they were put in this controlled environment, they were learners. They had the ability to learn. And one of the questions, and though it sounds odd, that I ask, and I don't know if you'll remember this, is should we have a minimum sentence in OYA? And it was interesting because of those kids that we saw in that program that were completing their educational and sometimes certification, welding, and a number of other programs, we say to ourselves, we're measuring recidivism, we're even measuring it when they end up in Department of Corrections. If we're going to spend money and this works, we ought to really dig in to see if it works, because they were doing a great job there, and it's an interesting idea that you know, if you put somebody there for 3 months, what good did they do? But if you put them there for long enough to get a high school diploma because their environment was preventing them from that happening, maybe we did them more good and we spent some extra money, but we did something right.
Did you want to comment, Mr. Chester?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, we did lose a principal to the Salem School District. She now is a principal of Sprague High School here in Salem, and is doing just an outstanding job there.
I would guess.
Some of the same youth that left McLaren are now on parole saw her again, and so she's just doing a great job, and she was wonderful. The new principal is also very good.
Senator Burdick.
We're out of time, so I'll hold my question until the budget presentation. Thank you.
Great. Well, we sure do appreciate the work, not only of you, but also your staff. I know, having done my practicum at McLaren years back, realize how difficult that work can be when things get tense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Let's close this committee hearing. Thank you all.